from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Chris Loffrey, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our segments podcast. Here's your weekly roundup in news coverage. On Friday, In the Moment host Lori Walsh hosted a roundtable regarding this week in State House politics. The panelists include SDPB's Stephanie Rissler, Seth Tupper, Lee Strubinger, and Jackie Hendry. Let's take a listen.
I'm going to start in Rapid City with you, Seth, and tell us a little bit about some of the legislation that you followed this week. Let's start with Senate Bill 55.
Yeah, I'm looking at a couple of really West River issues. Senate Bill 55 is a bill that Senator Ryan Maher, a Republican from Isabel, introduced. And when I talked to him about it, when it was still in draft stage, he was of the opinion that this was really going to rock the boat. And I said, well, what is it? And he said he was going to drop a bill to combine the administrations of the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology in Rapid City with the administration of Black Hills State University in Spearfish. And he views this as a cost-saving measure. He added up the 8 or 9 top salaries of the administrators at each school, and they were from $1 million to $1.5 million in total at each school. Mm-hmm. So he figures maybe you could save $1 million or $1.5 million by doing this. And
The boat he did?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And this goes back to the past, too. There's been attempts to do things like this in the past and save money by combining administrations or even putting the various state institutions under one flagship institution and making the rest like satellite schools. And I think he really wants to start the discussion. He doesn't expect this to pass this year. But when I did talk to him about it, here's a little bit of what he had to say.
Put that all under one administration, and they're 50 miles apart. It's 2020 with technology the way it is. There's no reason that you could not save the state some money by just combining administrations.
And Seth, this is part of a broader conversation in the future, because once you pull up the map and start looking at how close some of these other East River institutions are, we'll be hearing about this concept for a while, won't we?
Absolutely. I think this was just dipping his toe in the water, so to speak, starting with a couple of schools out here in the Black Hills. But I think he has his mind on perhaps, you know, seeing where the conversation goes.
All right, next, this is a story that you've been covering for quite some time, and people can find that work at rapidcityjournal.com. Now that you're with South Dakota Public Broadcasting, tell us what's the latest with the orphaned gas wells and how that ties into the legislative session, please.
Yeah, to make a really long story short,
right.
There's 40 natural gas wells operated by a company called Spyglass Cedar Creek out of Texas. The wells are up by Buffalo in northwest South Dakota. They've been sitting idle for a long time because the company fell on hard times and hasn't been able to do anything with them or plug them or reclaim them. So finally, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources has proposed a bill to allocate a little more than $700,000 in state funds to go and plug and reclaim those wells. So essentially, we the taxpayers would be footing the bill for plugging and reclaiming those idle wells. And they've proposed a couple of other bills that would allow them to capture another $130,000 in forfeited bonds from another project, move them over to this one. And then they also have a bill to raise the bonding minimums, because this project was only required to post $30,000 in bonds. The new bill would make the minimum $50,000 per well, or $100,000 for an unlimited number of wells for projects going forward.
All right. What's the conversation in Pierre sound like?
Well, they haven't had a hearing on it yet. This bill's awaiting a hearing. I did talk to a guy named Ray Gilbert, who's a rancher up by Buffalo, and is one of the guys who is stuck with these wells on his property and has been waiting for something to happen. And he really supports the higher bonding bill, because he thinks if they could have higher bonds, that would help. And here's what he said about that.
The good reputable companies aren't going to worry about paying it, because their reputation is at stake and they're going to do things right. And the fly-by-night outfits that we got in trouble with, they won't pay it probably. And now it's probably good, you know, keep them out, you know, keep the reputable companies in here.
Lessons learned for the future, right, Seth?
Well, we'll see. We'll see if the bills pass, right?
Seth Tupper, thank you so much for being with us. I know you have to head out, so we appreciate your time.
Thanks.
I'm going to jump to Jackie Henry here in the Sioux Falls studio. Jackie, let's talk about something that came up with the governor's State of the State address and was also mentioned by State Secretary of Education Ben Jones, and that's this JAG, Jobs for American Graduates. How are we seeing this legislation and peer unfold?
Well, so far it has received rousing support. So I, for one, didn't really know about the Jobs for America's Graduates program until recently, and it sounds like a lot of people, this was a similar story. So this program, it's a national nonprofit public-private partnership. It identifies middle and high school students with a variety of barriers to success that would be at a higher risk of dropping out of high school, and provides a variety of services to those students to prevent that. So things like career counseling, tutoring, mentoring, job shadowing opportunities, and all sorts of things like that.
All right, does it work?
Nationally, it sure looks like it. So on a national basis, the average graduation rate is 96% for those students at high school, and an 84% positive placement rate. And so they look at that as within a year after graduating high school, the 84% of students nationally who go through JAG are either in the military, in college, or in the workforce, or some combination of the three.
So something like this exists in South Dakota, but we're looking for more or better or what?
Right. So a handful of school districts have JAG programs in the state, and it's really up to those individual districts to organize that. The Wagner School District was the first in the state to adopt this program 11 years ago, and those success rates are even higher for those students, according to testimony in committee the other day. The principal of Wagner High School, Neil Goder, testified yesterday. He says he now has administrators from all around the state calling him for advice on bringing JAG to their schools, and here's what he had to say.
I said, I don't mind playing ball, but if I got to provide the diamond, the players, the gloves, the bats, the balls. So because Renee, Mrs. Vanderwerth, and I have been at it for the 10 to 12, 11 years, we seem to be the so-called experts in it. And so we take all the phone calls. We take all the, how do you do this? How do you do this? How do you do this? And that those are things that should come from our leadership from the state level, our leadership conferences for our students, our PD for our advisors. Those should come from the state level. They shouldn't come from us.
All right. Is that what this bill does, this Senate Bill 39?
For the most part, this bill would do three things. It centers the JAG program statewide in the State Department of Education. It establishes a donation fund. So, for instance, you know, businesses who offer job shadowing through JAG, they like this program. It's a workforce development thing for them, so they might want to donate money to the program. This sets up a fund so it's not district by district. It's a centralized thing that can then be allocated out. And then this bill would establish one full-time position in the State Department of Education to be the statewide JAG coordinator. So then again, having that leadership, that coordination, so it's not up to individual districts.
Sure. All right. There was no opposing testimony, but we're all wary of things that are too good to be true.
Right.
Did you find any skepticism about JAG?
The healthy skepticism, not so much about JAG itself, but when it comes to creating that one full-time position in the Department of Ag, that came from Senator Steinhauer. He pointed out that the current turnover in the Department of Education gave him a little bit of room for pause.
You got about 184 employees in the department. You've got turnover. By the time this bill goes into effect, you're going to have lost probably, you know, already 5-10 people. So if you need a specific skill set here, you can look for that person in the turnover. It doesn't, when we got a program, we don't necessarily always need to grow government. So I'd say I can't necessarily endorse a headcount ad, and I'm glad I'm not an appropriator. They got to make that decision.
So, Senator
Steinhauer. There are a lot of people in South Dakota who are glad they're not an appropriator.
Yeah, that's very true. So, Senator Steinhauer, he admits, you know, he's all about this program, thinks it's great, but he brings this up just almost as a warning to the Department of Ed in case they don't get that FTE approved, start coming up with other ideas of how to. You know, make that same service available. He also points out the governor's original budget address didn't have any room for additional funds for state employees, so it wouldn't make a lot of sense to add another position. But ultimately, the committee passed the bill unanimously, and those Senate education members had almost a little bit of bickering, who wanted to bring it to the Senate floor because they were so inspired by student testimonies and the success rate.
Right. I want to bring Stephanie Rissler into the conversation because last night South Dakota Focus was live talking about industrial hemp, one of the issues that's really top of mind for a lot of South Dakotans and lawmakers. Stephanie, did you just feel the energy in the room from listeners as well as they sent in their questions about this? There was kind of an overflow, it seemed.
I think a lot of folks across the state are paying close attention to what lawmakers are saying. Yesterday, yes, we really tried to dive into the issue. To the table, we had one of the main sponsors of the bill, Representative Orrin Lesmeister. He's from Parade, South Dakota. I also tried to reach out to those in the ag industry. We had the president of South Dakota Farmers Union, and I brought in those that work in the industry of hemp manufacturing, marketing. It was an interesting conversation, you know, to try to figure out if this is to pass, and if it does pass, there's an emergency clause on it, so it will go into effect immediately. What will this mean for our state?
Yeah, so Randy Stratton had something to say that really surprised me. Tell us a little bit about who he is and how he kind of goes back to that there was a time, this isn't necessarily a new conversation. I didn't know that.
I know, I did not either. Randy Stratton, he's with a group called Secure Crops. So really, he works with folks in specialty crops. So that's where industrial hemp will come in. He talked about growing up in South Dakota. He's from Lake County up by Madison. His family actually used to grow hemp until it was shut down in 1937.
Actually, my father farmed with my grandfather in Lake County. And some of their neighbors actually grew hemp as well. And there was a market in Minnesota because there were mills in Minnesota that would buy hemp for textiles and for rope and other things in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Mm-hmm. And so if you can imagine, along the I-29 corridor in South Dakota-Minnesota border, you had a lot of farmers right in that area that were growing hemp, and it was all being shipped up to Minneapolis to be processed. And my father remembers hearing his father say, "Now, why would the government stop that?" Because that's what they did in 1937. And my dad recalls that conversation.
Hmm. Yeah. All right, so the governor's expressed concerns, and one of the big concerns with people is about monitoring the people who want to cheat the system. What did you learn about some of those early efforts for starting a program like this in South Dakota?
You know, if you choose to grow or possess hemp and you get the licensure to do this, this really is giving the Department of Ag the consent to come in, take a look at what you're doing, take samples and test it. And of course, if you're found growing something you're not supposed to, they'll take all of what you've grown. You have to pay for it as a producer. I asked both Randy and Doug, president of Farmers Union, and what they both said is, if this passes, we are going to take baby steps and be very careful.
We're going to walk before we run with this industry. Yeah. And we're going to have to get some of the kinks out. And there's going to be potentially some, I don't know if paranoia is the right word, but there's going to be some concern that maybe there's more marijuana possibly coming into the state, mm-hmm. Trying to get under the radar. And so I guess the way I look at it is I hope that we would look at this as, is there probable cause to go on that property? Is there already something that sends a red flag up?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I mean, as far as routine inspections, I guess, I think routine inspections keeps everybody honest. And if we're gonna have it in law, then I think routinely we need to maybe go out and take a look at these things. But I hope that there's some way to keep this so that we're not, going over the top with it. I think probable cause maybe would be a way to look at that too.
So then, Doug, the follow-up is, if hemp is found to be in violation of the law, it can be confiscated by the Department of Ag, and then the cost of doing so will be paid by the grower or processor. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Listen, Stephanie, we're already doing a lot of this in South Dakota. If you're raising GMO product, whether it's corn or soybeans, you're already signing a license agreement that this can happen to you. Mm-hmm. A lot of people probably don't even realize it, but that's what happens. You can't keep the seed to replant it. It might not be a felony, mm-hmm. But they're allowed to come out into your crop and test it to see if you've been cheating the system.
Stephanie, as you saw those questions rolling in, and you know, you're having the live conversation with your guests, and did you think that a lot of people in South Dakota are concerned about, you know, they're kind of siding with the governor and having big concerns, or are they sort of leaning toward, you know, let's get this going and make the program happen?
The questions that came in last night were very much in favor of let's move forward. A lot of applause to those that were on the show for the ability to come forward with their information, their suggestions, their knowledge on the topic. A lot of folks saying this is just another tool for our farmers and ranchers who are already struggling. Let's get this done.
Another big issue this week was a House bill called 1057, and we're going to bring Lee Strubinger into the conversation from the Capitol building in Pierre. Lee, tell me about this big bill hearing of the week. Where did it come from, and how lawmakers, tell me about how lawmakers reacted to it. And again, 1057 is legislation to criminalize doctors, certain medical treatment for transgender youth, and looking at what doctors can provide. Tell us about how lawmakers are reacting to it and where the bill came from.
Sure. The earliest discussions I can find of this bill is Representative Fred Deutsch's travel to D.C. Deutsch is the prime sponsor of the bill, and he traveled to D.C. for a Heritage Foundation summit on protecting children from sexualization. His update in a LRC legislative report in November says, you know, that South Dakota should establish this legislation to criminalize doctors that provide sex change operations in children. We know several other states are considering similar legislation, states like Florida and Utah, and several others are talking about it. Supporters of the bill say this is about protecting children from abuse. It creates a class one misdemeanor for doctors who perform sex change procedures on minors, as well as provide puberty blocking hormones. Opponents say it infringes on the doctor-patient relationship, among other things. And a recent study, it just came out yesterday from the American Academy of Pediatrics, finds a direct correlation between puberty blockers in trans children and suicidal tendencies. Suicide among transgender individuals is about 35%. And what they found in that study for children who use those puberty blockers is that those suicidal tendencies tend to go down.
All right. So do we have a window into what Governor Noem is thinking about this bill?
We are about 15 minutes away from a Noem press conference, so we'll find out then. I'm sure she'll get asked about it. Meanwhile, I've been interviewing executive branch secretaries to see how their departments would respond to something like this passing. Secretary of Tourism Jim Hagan, there was a big tourism conference banquet last night, and you know, I asked what, you know, how tourism would deal with this, and he said that the state's tourism industry welcomes people with open arms regardless of political affiliation and ideology.
What we tell visitors is, listen, it doesn't matter what state you live in, city, municipality, you're always going to have legislation or proposed legislation that, you know, people may not agree with. But our message to them is, listen, when you come to South Dakota, this industry is going to welcome you with open arms. We're not checking IDs at the border. We're not checking political philosophies, ideologies. We want you to know you're welcome here.
The CDC says that, you know, 35%, as I said earlier, of trans people are susceptible to suicidal tendencies. And I talked with Lori Gill, the Secretary of the Department of Social Services. She and Secretary of Health Ken Malsom-Risden have been updating the legislature on their efforts to combat suicide in the state. During their presentation, they said targeted efforts for individual groups is how they are most successful in reducing suicide. So here's what Gill had to say when I asked about how they address trans side.
With a lot of different populations, it is effective to look at the strategies and maybe tweak them so that it is more effective. So there's multiple ways to look at that. We have lots of different strategies for different populations. So I would not exclude any particular group, because there's lots of ways to attack prevention using different methods for different groups of folks.
And last night, I attended the tourism banquet, as I mentioned earlier, and Governor Noem took a moment to talk about the governor's pheasant hunt in Sioux Falls. It's going to be the first one that is held there in 2020. And she said that the governor's pheasant hunt will be a way to attract industry to the state. And here's what else she had to say.
The heart and the mission of this event has always been to showcase South Dakota to business leaders who are looking to expand or to grow their business in our state.
And I play that clip because during her State of the State, you know, she said that South Dakota is open for business. And, you know, other groups are a little bit concerned about this bill. The South Dakota and Sioux Falls Chamber of Commerce oppose this legislation. They say it's draconian in its targeting of specific groups of people, in this case, trans children.
All right, Lee, let's look ahead to next week with everybody here gathered around the sort of virtual statewide table. Lee, let's start with you. What do you anticipate for next week in the South Dakota State Legislature?
Well, we're anticipating hearing House Bill 1057 on the House floor at some point. I don't know a day yet. But we're also anticipating the hemp bill that was talked about just earlier to drop. Legislators have been meeting with the governor's office this week to talk about amendments to the bill. Lawmakers I've spoken with, too, are pleased with those amendments, one of those being licensing for commercial driving as opposed to a farmer trucking some hemp to their home. And what I'm hearing is this could really come down to dollars, whether or not the state has that money to prop up this program initially.
All right. Mm-hmm. Stephanie Rissler, very briefly, what are you anticipating for next week?
Yeah, Senate Bill 51's coming up. This will authorize the possession of a concealed pistol by employees in county courthouses. Senator Lance Russell will introduce that. I'm going to keep my eye on that one.
All right, Jackie Hendry, in 15 seconds. Next week in the state legislature, big things to look for.
Senate Bill 66, providing for creation of and funding of Ocheti Chacoin charter schools. That's what I'm excited to hear in committee.
A new poll looks at the approval rating of Governor Kristi Noem. A South Dakota lawmaker says consolidation in higher education might help bring down tuition rates. And a bill addressing transgender health care hears testimony in Pierre. The Dakota Political Junkies joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh on Wednesday for a look at some of the state's top political headlines.
John Schaff is professor of political science at Northern State University in Aberdeen. Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist with Argus Leader Media. Jonathan joins us on the phone. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Lori.
Dr. Schaff, welcome.
Thanks for having me again.
Let's start with a piece that we just heard by SDPB's Seth Tupper about legislation from Ryan Maher about consolidation and looking at the costs of how much does it run different administrations, who's getting paid where, and is that an opportunity to make some changes? And I want to start with you, Jonathan Ellis, because Ryan Maher is talking in his proposed legislation, which he doesn't expect to have a lot of traction this year. He's kind of starting the discussion between Spearfish, Black Hill State University, and School of Mines in Rapid City. But if you look at the map, Jonathan, there are an awful lot of other universities in the state that are also pretty close together. Madison and Brookings are only 40 miles apart, for example. So if we look at geography, it's an interesting conversation. What are your thoughts about higher education consolidation?
Well, I mean, I think lawmakers are always looking for opportunities to save money, and higher education has been, use the right word here, but the percent of, I think, general funds have not necessarily stayed consistent over the years going into higher education. And so, you know, you have two institutions that are very different. I mean, I didn't attend either one of them, but, you know, they're kind of a tale of two schools. I mean, in 2010, you know, the total headcount for Black Hills was about 4,722, and now it's down, most recent year is down to 3,858. Mines, on the other hand, is up a little bit from where they were in 2010. So, you know, but they're two totally kind of different schools. And if you look at, obviously, Mines, the majority of those students are engineering, they're in sciences, and I think if you look at the data on Black Hills, that most of those degrees are in, for example, like education or business degrees. So they are totally different schools. I'm not in that industry, so I don't know what that would mean from an administrative point of view, but they certainly are not the same schools.
Well, we have somebody who is in that industry with John Chaff in Aberdeen, and I'm just wondering, you know, talk a little bit, if you will, from personal experience about what an administration at a university does and why it matters, because it's not interchangeable.
Yeah, the first thing to note is that I'm a Board of Regents employee, and everything I say is my own opinion. I do not speak for the Board of Regents. You always have to say that because there's always someone out there who doesn't understand that, that I only speak for myself. But nonetheless, I think, you know, what I think is interesting about Ryan Maher's proposal is that, you know, higher education is certainly going through tough times, and Jonathan sort of alludes to that with, say, the enrollment statistics at Black Hills, and that's sort of the story all over the place. School of Mines and, to a certain extent, Dakota State are two outliers bucking that trend. Most schools are finding themselves struggling with enrollment for all sorts of reasons. What I find interesting about the proposal is that when we look to save money in higher education, the savings usually come from either raising tuition on students or cutting faculty and staff. Rarely do people look at administration as cuts. And there's plenty of evidence that, you know, over the course of, say, even the last 30, 40 years, you can go back decades, that the increase in the United States, I'm not talking about national data, of number of students and number of faculty has basically tracked one another, whereas the increase in administration is skyrocketed as a percentage of where money goes in higher education. You know, like I say, faculty numbers track student numbers, but administration has just grown exponentially. And so, you know, Mr. Maher might be looking in the right area, though, you know, it's also worth noting, again, what Jonathan alludes to is that you have different institutions have different characteristics. And it sometimes is difficult to simply say that these parts are interchangeable. And administration is there in part to sort of give an institution a character. Institutions have particular missions. You know, the missions of Mines and Black Hills are not completely dissimilar, but they're relatively dissimilar. And you're probably going to get some sort of dissonance if you have one administrative unit trying to govern two institutions that have different missions. I don't think it's impossible. It probably could be done. But even Mr. Maher himself admits this is unlikely to pass this year. And it's probably something you'd have to do a lot of heavy thinking about how each institution would carry on their particular characters and their particular missions.
Let's talk about some breaking news, which is that the House Bill 1057 did pass out of committee, the House State Affairs Committee, this morning. And this is a bill that addresses transgender youth health care issues and criminalizes certain procedures. It was amended in that committee. Lee Sturbinger is working on that report right now. It used to be dealing with students under 18. Now it's under 16. It's been reduced to a Class 1 misdemeanor instead of a felony. Other changes as that bill goes forward. But, Jonathan, this is another thing, and I want to tie this into something that you recently wrote about bills that are unconstitutional and taxpayers paying for them or state government paying for them. There are consequences to this kind of legislation that we might see in the future. Can you make that connection for us?
Well, I mean, if this bill were to pass, it would almost certainly be challenged legally. You alluded to the other bill or the other voter initiative that passed in 2018 that was also challenged and found to be unconstitutional, and obviously the taxpayers got stuck with the attorney fees on that. But this particular issue would almost certainly be challenged legally, because as opponents have pointed out, that they're creating a class of, or targeting a class of people or one particular population for what they say is medically necessary medical care. I would expect that this would be challenged.
John Schaff, the South Dakota Chamber of Commerce spoke out against this House Bill 1057 as well, and specifically talked about triggering economic consequences that include the loss of conventions, tournaments, top-level entertainment, and business investment from outside industries. Is that rhetoric? Is that the real deal? Do we see an economic consequence for legislation that comes out of peer that can be negative?
It certainly can be. There's a political scientist at Williams College, Daryl Paul, who wrote a book a couple years ago about this, about the way essentially he was talking more so about the gay rights movement, and this is a sort of cousin to that, I suppose, the transgendered movement, how corporately driven this movement was. And you see this in things like when Indiana passed a religious freedom bill, how institutions such as Walmart, Apple, the NCAA threatened to boycott the state, when North Carolina passed one of those so-called bathroom bills, and the NBA moved the All-Star Game, the National Basketball Association moved its All-Star Game out of Charlotte. And so what you see, it's an interesting argument that it's using a corporate capitalist strategy to try to attack what is essentially a cultural issue. And what Daryl Paul basically concludes in his book and articles that he's written on this subject is that it's interesting that the argument goes hand in hand, that what corporate America wants is people to have unlimited choice, unlimited freedom, in the sense that there's any kind of limit, that any desire you can't fulfill, right? You should be able to fulfill whatever desire you want to have. And so corporate America and the Chamber of Commerce likes the idea of unlimited freedom, and any limit is a bad thing. And it's just sort of interesting that what we have here is a corporate interest siding against, which we normally align with, the conservative side of the political spectrum, in this case aligning against the conservative side of the political spectrum, because it's just interesting that the argument is made is not that this is wrong, but that it will hurt the bottom line and that we can't do this thing because we might lose money. And I think it's just kind of an interesting turn on the way these things often play out, slight twist.
When you say whatever desire you want to have, I think it's important to tie back to what Jonathan said, and that the people who are in the situation wouldn't call this a desire that they want to have. They would call it a medical necessity, a medical procedure.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Is that, yeah. Jonathan misspeaks in one point, because the penalty is not against, it's not against the penalty. It's not a penalty against the people themselves. It's a penalty against doctors. And so this is the big question, is what is the medical necessity? So you have world-renowned psychologists such as Paul McHugh, who is the former head of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, or Kenneth Zucker, who literally wrote the DSM entry on sexual dysphoria, who say when you're dealing with young people, the best thing to do is to help them identify with their birth sex, with their biological sex, and only later would you consider transitioning. And so in that sense, some of the best of the psychiatry is on Fred Deutsch's side. And you have another question of what he's talking about is doing medical interventions on people who are physically completely healthy. And so, for example, would you remove perfectly healthy breast tissue because a female identifies as a male, and whether that's the appropriate use of medicine? So the argument isn't about the individual who has sexual dysphoria. The question is whether the medical professional who is licensed by the state of South Dakota is using that medical license in an appropriate way by, for example, doing a medical intervention, including surgery, on a body that is physically 100% healthy. And this is why this is a fraught subject. And obviously, this is going to come up over and over and over again. And these are the kinds of things that we have to have dialogue. And it sounds like there was some dialogue at the legislature this morning, because they amended the thing to kind of lower the stakes, so to speak.
And then that goes back to some of the conversations we had the last time on this program, when a transgender legislative piece package came up, and healthcare providers were coming in and saying everything that we do is about what can we delay? How can we help people express an identity in a different way? Can you use a different name? You know, how long can we put off a procedure as we all work together to sort of figure out what is happening in this very fraught conversation? Very difficult for parents, and it also restricts parents with some of the choices that they have, because these children don't, a 13-year-old doesn't go into a doctor by themselves. They go in with adults who are doing a lot of research and trying to advocate for their children. So much to talk about here on this, but I want to make sure to get to something that Jonathan Ellis just published this morning, and that is about marijuana and what a difference a decade makes. makes. And Jonathan, you can find this at argusleader.com. Give us a little background about the last 10 years and how this sort of began as an issue that that meant one thing 10 years ago, and today it means something slightly different.
Well, I mean, you have to go back to 2006, and it was on the ballot in 2006, and it was really kind of overshadowed by other things that were taking place in that election, and nobody really paid a whole lot of attention to it. And medical marijuana almost passed. I mean, it was very close. And that was very alarming to people who were opposed to that. And so when it reemerges on the ballot in 2010, you had the South Dakota State Medical Association sort of leading a coalition against it. Campaigning against it that didn't exist in 2006, and so it soundly beat. But since then, I mean, we've had dozens of states that have enacted some sort of legalization or decriminalization, some regulatory scheme. Some of it's just for medical, some of it's for medical and recreational. It really is, in my mind, sort of an example of federalism. Of course, it's still illegal at the federal level. And so now it's back. And just to break a little news about that issue, I got a message that Dre Samuelson will be the political advisor for those campaigns. So they're back. And I think a lot of people are looking around and seeing how other states have done this. And I think that there's a possibility that one of these might pass, maybe the medical marijuana. I would probably bet against both of them at this point, but I think that we're getting closer in this state, and I think eventually, absent some kind of major scientific breakthrough that says marijuana is terrible for you, or I think eventually this is going to pass, even in South Dakota. We may be one of the last states, but I think it will be here at some point.
Right. One of the lines from the Argus Leader piece that Jonathan wrote is that marijuana, which remains illegal under federal law, has become a paragon of federalism, that glorious model of government in which states and localities serve as laboratories of democracy. Just had to read that out loud. John Shaw.
That's a column. Just so we know, that's a column, not a news story.
That is right. This is one of those days where, yes, John Shaw is expressing his own opinions, not the opinions of the Board of Regents. And Jonathan Ellis wrote a column in the Argus Leader, which allows a little more latitude. Everybody
right.
Good?
Okay. I'm just trying to hold back the tears at the beauty of Jonathan's prose.
I'm just throwing out a good sentence. That's all I'm saying. Right? Sometimes you got to call it out.
Yeah, I think there are a couple things going on there. You mentioned, I think that probably medical marijuana is far more likely to become legalized in this state than recreational marijuana. And I think there was a movement, I think Jonathan's right, that probably up to, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years ago, there was obviously a significant movement in the country that was pro-recreational use of marijuana. I think that slowed down a little bit as we get data coming in from other states. And Colorado, of course, is the classic example of there's at least some regret, I think, coming out of Colorado that they're finding that long-term use of marijuana maybe isn't as healthy as they thought it was. A lot of driving while under the influence of marijuana. There's a long article, I want to say it was in the New Yorker, about the marijuana today is not your daddy's marijuana. The THC levels are higher, and so the consequences of its use are more dire, which doesn't mean that we don't legalize it, but it makes that argument a little bit harder. And I just think the irony is that if through ballot initiatives we're talking about loosening our restrictions on marijuana while our legislature is trying to raise the age at which you can buy a cigarette, or actually I think it's any tobacco product, right? I'm trying to think of what the actual bill says. And so we're making it harder to buy cigarettes and vaping materials while we're making it easier to purchase marijuana. And we need to maybe go one way or go the other way, because we seem to be working at cross purposes there. Either we let everyone do what they want, or we get serious about we use the public health argument to restrict both of them. It seems weird that we're saying more marijuana, less vaping, and we got to get our story straight on this.
And what's more controversial? Oh, go ahead, Jonathan.
Oh, I was just going to say, it sounds like the legislature is just creating an additional black market. I mean, and what marijuana legalization does with us is, if it's done done in the right way, it kind of eliminates the black market, but which will always exist. So, yeah.
What's more controversial than marijuana and transgender people seeking health care services, plastic straws and plastic bags? Let's just end with a proposed legislation to ban a ban. And this is essentially legislation hoping to make it so individual cities cannot ban plastic bags and plastic straws. And I got to admit, I never knew this was such a hot button topic until you start talking about plastic straws. Who wants to start with the idea of peer banning a ban so that cities can't ban a product?
I will say that I was in Washington, D.C. earlier. Well, I guess it's 2020 now, isn't it? So late last year, I was in Washington, D.C., and I had to drink through a paper straw, and it was substandard.
Did you have to drink through a paper straw? Or
yes.
Did you have
it's,
not used
oh, this
a straw
is true.
At all?
Well, which is what I ended up doing is just throwing the straw away because it was it basically, it made my Coke taste like paper. But I saw a brilliant tweet by, there's this reporter at the Argus Leader, last name of Ellis, I think is his name. And I think he was right. I think Jonathan was right. I have yet to see the burning desire from any local government in the state of South Dakota to ban plastic bags or plastic straws. And so I think we have a solution in search of a problem. And I'm all for plastic straws. But I don't.
Are you? Is that the hill, is that the hill you want to die on?
This is the one I will die on. In fact, I've got T-shirts I'm making about plastic straws. But I'm pro-choice on straws. If you want to use a paper straw, okay. Go right ahead. You know, I feel like they're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, and it seems like someone is trying to take a position for some other reason to show we're not like those people in San Francisco.
Right. And
I think we already knew that.
We're being flip about it, but Jonathan, it all goes back to flooding in Sioux Falls and the river being completely saturated with plastic bags that were washing up. So the problem that people are pointing out to is one of climate change and garbage and waste and plastic floating everywhere. So, in all fairness, we've had our fun, but there is a real issue at stake here. What a great First Amendment conversation today. John Schaff, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Ellis, thank you so much.
We'll do it again.
President Trump addressed the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention and trade show in Austin, Texas last week and said the best days for American farmers are yet to come. South Dakota Farm Bureau Federation President Scott Vanderwall was reelected as American Farm Bureau Federation vice president for another two-year term. Prior to the convention, Vanderwall accompanied Governor Kristi Noem to Washington, D.C. for the signing of what's being called Phase 1 of a new trade deal with China. Vanderwall joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh to talk about trade, USMCA, and how South Dakota looks to benefit.
Scott, welcome. Thanks for making time for South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning, Lori. Glad to be with you.
You've had an exciting week. There's lots of news to catch up on. And let's start with this Phase 1 trade deal. What exactly does it mean for South Dakota farmers? What is there to be excited about? And what is there to sort of still have patience for?
Well, this is pretty big news. And you were right. I had the opportunity, which was an honor, to go out to Washington, D.C. and witness the signing along with Governor Noem, and I was representing American Farm Bureau at that event. This is truly a historic occasion. And just to give you a little background, I happened to be sitting behind Henry Kissinger. And as they were going through the ceremony, I was thinking, what's going through his mind? You know, he was Secretary of State in the 70s when we were really clashing heads with the communists, both in Russia, the USSR at that time, and China. And how he viewed the progress we've made since then and up until that day where we were actually signing a trade agreement with China. And reportedly, he said it was a remarkable achievement. So that's quite a compliment to the Trump administration. As far as the effect for South Dakota, most of the products we raise in South Dakota will be included in that trade deal. And there's nothing written in the trade deal about how many dollars worth of soybeans or pork or beef are going to go over there. The way it's written is they get to choose depending on what their needs are. But the bottom line is it's $40 billion per year average over the next 2 years that they will be importing from the United States. And the most we've ever exported to them in recent memory anyway is about $27 billion. And that's billion with a B. So that's quite an increase over our highest ever. And we've been down quite significantly under that, like not much over 10 or 12. So it's a huge opportunity for America's farmers and ranchers to sell our products and to create more demand for those products.
What does phase one look like as far as, like, are there other phases? Do we have an idea of what the big picture looks like? Or is that the big picture and then you need to break it down to phase one?
No, phase one is just the beginning, and of course, we have to implement that yet. So a lot of farmers and ranchers are saying, well, show me the results. And that's true. We haven't moved any more soybeans or corn or beef or pork, and the markets haven't really responded to it yet because they're saying, show us the results. So the implementation is the big thing. President Trump did talk about what he expects to be phase two, and that is where they'll go back to work and work on what comes after the second year. And I asked Secretary Perdue about that the other day when he was here at our convention also. And he said that right now phase one is just 2020 and 21, I believe, 2 years. And then phase two will take over from that. And from there, they hope to escalate our exports to China and make a more permanent long-term deal out of it. When President Trump was signing the deal last week at the White House, he said that the tariffs that are in place now will not come off until after they finish phase two. He sees that as leverage to get everybody back to the table again. And I guess I can't argue with that.
So that $40 billion average that you mentioned, that is phase one. That's the next 2 years. During that time, the same tariffs will be in place.
Yeah, same tariffs will be in place. Phase one is the $40 billion per year, so a total of $80 billion over 2 years.
All right. So are you aware of some of the other concessions that the president was looking for from China had to do with intellectual property and areas of theft? And were those areas addressed that you're aware
yes.
of, or is that kind of separate from where you're concerned with?
No, they did talk about that, and it is included in phase one. A lot of those little irritations, which are big to a lot of people, stealing intellectual property, there's about three or four different areas where they were not following their obligations under WTO. And President Trump made it very clear that they have concessions on that from the Chinese, that they will follow those obligations, and they have enforceability built into it, where we can unilaterally apply tariffs and other penalties if they're not following what they agreed to. I don't know how that all goes, if it has to go through WTO
right,
or
yeah.
not in a case like that. That's not specified in the information we have. But at least it's a lot more concrete than we've had before with these loose agreements where they just they come and go and they buy something, and if the market goes the wrong way, they'll cancel the shipment and then come back and buy some more. And so this trade deal really adds a lot more certainty than we've had before in regard to China.
You mentioned, some farmers saying, okay, well, show me what happens next with the implementation. But you were in the East Room of the White House witnessing that signing as part of that delegation. Tell me a little bit, with the acknowledgement that not everything has been realized yet, what the energy was like in the room during the signing. Take us there.
Well, it was really a celebratory atmosphere. There were a lot of us from agriculture there, and there were also a lot of CEOs from industry, big industries like Boeing and some of the big, like General Electric. The CEO was there from General Electric. Lots of those types of people, and he introduced them. Of course, we were with Farm Bureau there, soybeans, corn, National Cattlemen's, all the national organizations were there as well. And it was a very, like I said, a celebratory atmosphere because this is something we've been waiting for and looking for a couple of years, clear back to early 18 when the tariff and trade disputes with China started. That's the same time that the soybean market decreased about $2 a bushel. which triggered the market facilitation program that the administration put on. And all of those things have just led up to really strong expectations and desires to get more trade deals done and export our products across the world. And it doesn't stop with China. They've got an agreement with Japan, an agreement with beef with the European Union, and they certainly expect to go to a lot of other countries, too, once they get these done.
For South Dakota farmers and producers who are feeling the pinch right now as they wait for implementation and the results, I understand there's more subsidies released recently. What's the immediate picture?
Well, yeah, the pain isn't over with, and certainly the 2019 crop year is going to have a long tail, especially in South Dakota, North Dakota, and part of Minnesota. We've got a lot of flooded areas yet that froze that way, so next spring it's going to be wet again, and some people aren't real optimistic about the planting season next year. So the market facilitation program that I mentioned, we had the first and second tranches, which the first tranche was half of it, and then the second was a fourth, so there's a fourth left. And Secretary Perdue said that'll be coming soon here in early 2020. So that'll certainly help. It's very appreciated by especially people that aren't well capitalized, maybe young farmers that don't have a lot of capital behind them, or older farmers that are tired of seeing their equity slip away, that might be thinking about getting out. Might keep them in business for a couple more years at least until things turn around. Certainly long-term farmers and ranchers want to get their income from the market. But until those trade deals kick in and start increasing the markets, those assistance packages are certainly appreciated, because the retaliatory tariffs that were put on by other countries were something that were not asked for by our industry, and it's an outside influence that's affecting our markets and our prices artificially.
Take us home to South Dakota for a minute, and after Governor Kristi Noem's State of the State address recently, she leaned heavily on business and agribusiness in the state. What do you know about what to look forward to from Governor Noem's administration that farmers should be aware of?
Well, we've got a great relationship with Governor Noem going back to when she was in the U.S. House of Representatives and worked with us on lots of things there. The thing we talked with her about mostly is livestock development and how we can keep our young people in South Dakota. We're raising some amazing talent and a tremendous work ethic in our young people, only to see them leave the state in a lot of cases. And we need to find ways to keep them in our state, keep that talent here, keep that work ethic here, and improve our state with that talent rather than exporting it to other states. So we've talked to the governor about what we can do livestock zoning-wise, also having to do with public opinion about livestock operations. You know, South Dakota's got a lot of wide-open spaces. We've got the very high-quality livestock. We've got the high-quality feed that's probably less expensive than any other place in the country. So there's really no reason why we shouldn't be raising the livestock and feeding them in South Dakota. And we just need to convince our friends that live in the towns and cities, maybe on acreages out in the country, that it really creates economic activity and contributes to the economy of South Dakota.
I want to ask a political question, because this is an election year, and President Trump's remarks at this convention, or at this conference for the American Farm Bureau Federation, included, celebrating the rolling back of regulations from the Obama administration. So you've got the Obama administration with a heavy use of executive orders, the Trump administration, heavy use of executive orders. And I'm wondering just about sort of whiplash as you sort of watch American voters choose their next president. How hard is it to plan for stability when you have administrations that might have vastly different viewpoints of, everything from what can be used on land to waters of the U.S.?
Right. That's a great question. And certainly the waters of the U.S. issue has been one that's at the top of the list for us. We've been fighting that and trying to get it repealed ever since it was put in place in 2015, and finally the Trump administration did that earlier in the fall of 2019. It was a huge overreach of government regulation. It was not put in place correctly, and the courts have upheld that. And so the EPA withdrew that, and they're coming with a new one, which will be less intrusive In other words, it's going to leave the water issues and regulation of water issues to the states and local areas where it needs to be, rather than having somebody in a smoke-filled office in Washington, D.C. decide on what happens out in western South Dakota, out in the middle of nowhere, what they've never seen. And by the middle of nowhere, I mean to them that they consider a flyover country. So when we first got that 2015 rule, what it would have done is put most of the land area in the country under federal jurisdiction. And we felt that that was not appropriate. And the courts also agreed with that by putting injunctions on it. So then after those injunctions, about half of the country were under the jurisdiction of the clean the waters of the U.S. rule, and half weren't. And with the new rule that we expect to be coming now, first of all, like I said, it'll evolve a lot more common sense, but also it'll be more clear. And that's one thing we've asked for. Farmers and ranchers should not have to hire lawyers and engineers to go out on their land and determine what parts of it are under federal jurisdiction and what parts aren't. And under the new rule, we think we've got a good idea what it's going to look like. We think that's going to be a lot more clear. And we need to help assure people that the new rule will still protect water quality. Farmers and ranchers want to protect the water quality because we depend on it for our livelihood. And there's no reason we would abuse that. And people need to understand that. And the new rule will still protect water quality, but still let our businesses and our farms succeed economically.
Scott Vanderwall is president of the South Dakota Farm Bureau Federation. Scott, we hope you'll come back and when you return from Austin and talk to us again about things that are new that affect all of us. Thank you so much.
I certainly will, and thank you very much.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Loffrey. Thank you for listening.